The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Continuing a theme of Saturday night political resignations, last week we saw Brian Stanley. This week we see Heather Humphreys, the deputy leader of Fine Gael, announcing overnight that she is departing as deputy leader and that she is departing politics. She says in her statement, "After much consideration, I have decided not to seek re-election at the next general election and I will step down as deputy leader." She then goes on to give a précis of what she sees as her successes and then goes, "I have always enjoyed the job and I have always looked forward to coming to work every day. Politicians are human too. We give all we can for as long as we can, but time catches up on all of us. As I get older, my health and energy levels are not what they were, and I know going forward that I would not be able to give the job the time and commitments it deserves." Sean Defoe is with us, News Talk's political correspondent. Sean, you know that line about one reason being a reason, two reasons being an excuse. Do we know precisely why she has stepped down?
No, beyond her statement, we don't know if there's any one particular thing when she references her health that is wrong or the energy that has kind of dipped down for her. And it does come as a surprise because when Simon Harris took over as Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader earlier on this year, he sort of asked for a commitment from his ministers that they were running again. And at the time, not only was Heather Humphreys running again, but she did deal with him to become deputy leader of Fine Gael and of the party at the time, and looked as though someone who was going to be a really big part of Fine Gael's election hopes. Since then, obviously, something has changed for her and she's decided now to step away.
It seems strange to step away this close to an election. I mean, we're at the point of speculation suggesting that it could be within 6 weeks. It's getting very close to the wire, isn't it?
Very, very close, yeah. And it's very damaging for Fine Gael in Cavan Monaghan in particular, because she was sort of put down as an automatic seat, and actually to be challenging for a second Fine Gael seat there if the wind is behind them. And given that she had such a big presence and has risen to the very senior ranks that she has in the party and in the cabinet over the last few years. So it's quite damaging for them, and it is a very close point to the election. We don't know exactly what the tipping point was. I mean, she had a very intense budget negotiation, but got almost everything that she wanted out of the budget. Perhaps that fed into some of the thinking in that, here, I'm going to go out on a high, and actually ended on my terms, perhaps facing down the barrel of actually hitting the doorsteps for that 3 to 5 week campaign, whatever it's going to be. And then another 5 years actually in government might have shaped the thinking as well. I know there are some within Fine Gael who thought they'd be in opposition benches for a while there, and now looks as though they may well be back into government. So perhaps that played into the thinking. We don't 100% No, in fairness to Heather Humphreys, you know, from interviewing her and being around her over the years, she's a relatively straight shooter on these things and may have just decided that the time was now. The job has changed pretty significantly, especially for female politicians in the last 10 years.
But she does leave them in an interesting position in that there is a triplicate of jobs there that could have helped other candidates. The deputy leadership brings some cachet. A ministerial appointment, were it to be made available 4 or 5 months ago, might have brought some cachet and a bit of a promotion. And the burnishing of a reputation to a backbencher. And likewise, whoever is going to take the run for the seat in the constituency, I'm sure would have liked a longer run-up than they're now going to get.
Yeah, well, they're like you say, they're kind of all there. And that's why Simon Harris had asked earlier on this year, "Look, confirm to me so we can get our ducks in a row here," because very little election preparation had been done up to that point. We know this morning that Helen McEntee is going to be the deputy leader. She has been named in that role pretty much straight away by Simon Harris. That helps her a little bit after what's been a difficult couple of years, but also I think probably helps the image that Harris is trying to put forward. If we are a young Fine Gael, a new Fine Gael, and you've got a deputy leader and a deputy and a leader who are both under the age of 30, so are going to be kind of dynamic in that. T.P. O'Reilly is the other candidate on the Cavan Monaghan ticket for Fine Gael. He's run before and would have been seen to have a decent enough chance in a five-seater. Now is probably going to get in the seat, but putting a running mate in behind him becomes a little bit more difficult. Certainly the timing of it. But look, when you talk to people in Fine Gael, very few people are going to begrudge her this, because Heather Humphreys had really built up this level of respect in the party in the last 10 years. It's sort of a fascinating rise in that when she was appointed to the cabinet in July 2014 as a first-time TD, she was kind of seen as a gender geography candidate, if we're being honest. A lot of people went, "Who?" when she was appointed. But she is the only member alongside Pascal Donoghue of that cabinet to still be at the cabinet table 10 years later, and has become this sort of matriarchal figure, almost akin to a Frances Fitzgerald within Fine Gael over the last few years. So her loss, even as a sort of a strategist and an advisor to the party and to those younger ministers who are around the cabinet table now, I think it's a pretty big blow.
Interesting you reference Frances Fitzgerald. Frances Fitzgerald is about 18 inches away from me, and we'll get her take on it in one second. I should say we have had a flurry of statements this morning. One, of course, by Helen McEntee, saying it is a great honour to be appointed Deputy Leader of Fine Gael, and I give my all to the role, and I thank Simon Harris for placing his trust in me. And then another from the Taoiseach saying that he pays tribute to Minister Heather Humphreys TD and appoints a new Deputy Leader, saying Heather Humphreys has been a trailblazer in Irish politics. Does this give us to, do we therefore believe that they knew this was coming, or have they just been writing furiously since dawn?
A small few in the party seemed to have known it was coming, but they kept it very, very tight. There had been a little bit of speculation in Cavan Monaghan when she was a bit vague about her intentions going into the selection convention, but it certainly was not widely known. This was pretty shocking stuff when it came out to a lot of people last night that she was stepping away. And it does provide, I'd be interested actually, you can put this to Frances or not as you will, because obviously the other big story about Fine Gael in the papers today is that they are absolutely bouncing high in the polls and 24% and 5 points clear of the nearest party. But this sort of presents the perfect example of how the constituency profile for Fine Gael does not fit the national picture, in that you could have seen on the national picture Fine Gael challenging for two in a 5-seat constituency like Cavan Monaghan. Now that seems to be out the window because she's gone. You look at Dublin Bay South, you've got a former TD in Kate O'Connell probably scuppering the chances for a second seat now in Dublin Rathdown. Alan Shatter, former minister, now independent, probably scuppering the chances for other seats. And then other pockets around the country where the candidates aren't very well bedded in, or there's different local dynamics at play that make it difficult to say that Fine Gael will absolutely come on top with one or two seats here. So while a lot of the talk will be Fine Gael riding high, we're going into the election, the leaders are chatting about it tomorrow, and we should hopefully know the date in the next few days, when you actually drill down into the constituency figures, it's not quite as rosy.
As ever, Sean, thank you very much. Sean Defoe, Group Political Correspondent at Bauer Media. I will put some of those issues to Frances Fitzgerald, who is with me. Of course, Frances Fitzgerald, former Minister and Fine Gael MEP. Joining us as well this morning is Conor Pope, Consumer Affairs Editor with the Irish Times, and Paul Gallagher, who is a Director, Non-Exec Director in Tourism Ireland and General Manager of Buzzwells Hotel. Frances, let me obviously begin with you. The fact that Kate O'Connell was not brought within the fold, though it looked like a lot of olive branches were presented, the fact that Heather Humphreys was given the deputy leadership and 6 months later decides to fling it back and depart, the fact that Alan Shatter wasn't brought within the fold, bit of a criticism in there of Simon Harris's capacity to build relationships?
I don't think so. They're all very individual stories, not necessarily predictable. Kate wasn't offered a place on the ticket, and Emma Blane is running, very good candidate. That's the reality of what happened there for a whole variety of reasons, but I'm sure they were very good
reasons.
There did
look to be an attempt at a rapprochement, though, was there not?
Well, there was. But, you know, the final decision had not been taken, and then it was taken, and Kate decided to go independent, as was her right. And, of course, you often find with independents in Ireland, they're former party members. You know, this is a very common trend. Obviously, you have people who are independents following their own independent agenda, but often they're ex, you know, members. So there's a lot of political stories in the papers today, and Heather is obviously a very big one. I take her at her word. It's about health and it's about energy. And, you know, you never quite know.
How did she not know her health and energy in April?
It's an interesting question, but, you know, you never know the dynamics that shape a decision like that. It's such a big decision. And for whatever, you know, number of reasons, obviously now she felt it was the right time. Maybe she was ambivalent about it. Maybe, you know, there were, you know, family factors. You just never quite know. But I think we have to respect that she's saying it's health and energy, and that she's given the 20 years. And at this point, she feels that she's done enough, had enough. And I would pay tribute to her as a rural woman representing Cavan Monaghan. And we have very good local candidates, and we got a great local result there. So I would be optimistic. I don't agree with Sean. I think we could go for the two seats.
Oh, you think two seats are possible, do you?
I do, because I think Helen had a huge vote herself that really never got divided. It's just the reality of her appeal in Cavan Monaghan. And we've got a really good local election result there. So I think we have good candidates ready to go there. And if we are at 24%, I mean, Sean makes the point about new candidates, but we have a lot of new young and older new candidates. Very enthusiastic and known in their local community. You know, known in their local community.
But presumably that brings a significant challenge for a party. You're looking at, I think, if there's a replacement of possibly 18 TDs, if I have the numbers correctly,
yes.
It'll be one of the biggest demographic shifts in a party in recent political memory. And it throws out an awful lot of experience, an awful lot of groundwork.
Yes, but just think about some of the changes you've seen in party politics. We've had elections where we gained 20 seats. with 20 new candidates going back since the 2000s. You know, we've gone from 30 to 50.
Which tends to come on foot of an anti-government vote. It is very rare for an existing incumbent government party to swap out its people.
That's right. And when you've been in government for the length of time that we have, I think it's understandable to see the changeover. I think it reflects society generally. I mean, you're seeing people's careers. I remember Bertie Ahern saying, he might even have said it in this studio, the days of having people 20 to 30 years in politics are probably gone, in line with the way our society is changing, people having 2 to 3 careers, moving between, you know, different areas. I think you're seeing that in politics now. But we also have candidates coming forward, even though they might be new, they'd be very well known in their constituencies for a whole variety of reasons.
How resentful will Simon Harris be? Because he would have been enjoying, I would have thought, some sense of momentum, and having his deputy leader say, out of the blue, I don't want to take part in this anymore, it can't be what he hoped for.
You know, that's the pay grade of being Taoiseach. I mean, it's a shock a day. I think that's just the reality. You're coping with, you know, shocks of one sort or another, personal. You're managing a very complex organisation as well as obviously being Taoiseach of the country. So, I mean, he's already appointed Helen McEntee deputy leader, and congratulations to Helen. I think that's a great appointment. You know, she has been a trailblazer, taking her maternity leave, first time ever to have, you know, we've had a minister who's gone on maternity leave, and there was a lot of pressures on her, and there was a lot of comments about that.
There was a lot of criticism and political flack as well.
That's my point, that it wasn't seen as almost an acceptable thing to do, which is outrageous.
No, not in relation to her maternity leave. There was criticism of her dealing with the far right. There was criticism of the way that she dealt with issues relating to riots and protest around the immigration issue. She has not had an entirely rosy political profile on her way to the deputy.
Do I know? It's never been easy being Minister for Justice, and she has had a challenging time. And, you know, dealing with organised crime in this city or internationally has never been easy, but she's put a lot of things in place. We did suffer post-COVID. I mean, Templemore was closed. That's the reality. So the recruitment of Gardaí did slow down, and we really do need to bring it up. And she's doing everything to do that and giving them more powers and the cameras and so on. And she's brought in a lot of new legislation. So, yeah, she's had a tough time. She's been heavily criticised. But, you know, I think that's the name of the game now in politics. It's a like many professions, it's a tough one.
Did you see this coming with Heather Humphreys?
No, I didn't, I have to say, and I would imagine most members of Fine Gael didn't. It is a surprise, undoubtedly. No doubt she would have confided in a number of people, but of course it's a surprise, definitely. But I take her at her word. It's not political in that sense. It's health and energy, and I guess she's decided she's given it as much as she could, and she's making way for somebody else. And it is a surprise. But, you know, I think the party will deal with it. And Helen is now deputy leader, and we'll be running. You know, I'm not quite sure who they'll be at this point. But as I say, good result there in the locals. And I think that will carry through to the general with that poll with Fine Gael at 24%.
Does it say something about the cohesion and the closeness of the parliamentary party and those around it that your deputy leader could have this level of dissatisfaction and nobody spotted?
No, but I think dissatisfaction is the wrong word, Anton. I mean, this is a personal decision, which is a very tough personal decision for her to take. It's not dissatisfaction with the party. It's a decision at a particular point in her life and career that another 5 years, and remember now, generally in elections, you're talking and thinking about a 5-year stint. I mean, I made the decision myself not to go forward in Brussels for another 5 years. And I can understand when suddenly, you know, I guess people would have liked if it was earlier, but it is what it is, and one moves on.
There's obviously an awful lot of political coverage in the papers. Much of it, I think the Mail is the only one that went to bed late enough to be able to get some of the Heather Humphreys stories squeezed in. But there is a huge amount on Sinn Féin, and I'll be getting Paul Gallagher and Conor Pope's view on that and more in a couple of minutes. Before that, let me give you a shot at the cash machine.
News Talk's cash machine.
So our cash machine keeps giving out life-changing amounts of money. There's €200,000 up for grabs next Friday. It is guaranteed somebody's taking it away. If you want to win it, you take a note of the exact amount, you enter, and if we call you and you give us the right number, you win the cash. Cash machine amount, €200,000 exactly. You can text the word play to 57557. That's 57557. Cost is €2.50 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Go Live network of stations, and full terms are on newstalk.com. Get your entry in by 3 p.m. on Friday, October 25th, and then the cash machine will randomly pick one entry, and it could be you that gets the call during Moncrief. Answer within 5 rings, tell us the prize amount, and the cash is yours. That number again, €200,000 exactly. It strikes me, Conor, that nothing ends a political career like being made deputy leader of Fine Gael.
Possibly, very possibly. But I do think the only thing that really is of interest here is the timing, because Heather Humphreys is perfectly entitled to say, listen, politics is a draining career, and Lord knows the pressure these people are under all of the time, and you've got people hanging off you every second of every day. I don't know how politicians do it. It wouldn't be for me, and I suspect it wouldn't be for you either. So it is an incredibly demanding job, and she has been a minister for 10 years. But the fact that she's announcing her departure 3 weeks, possibly 5 weeks before a general election is just extraordinarily peculiar, because it leaves the party in a very difficult position. And right now, the party should be just sitting back and soaking up all of the benefits they're getting from the huge pressure that Sinn Féin, who like a year ago would have been the party that were primed for government. But instead now they're going to have to be talking about this for the next 3 or 4 days. And, you know, it's a peculiar timing. The timing of the decision is peculiar, but fair play to her for making that decision. And by the way, I thought it was funny what you said about, did she not know what her energy levels would be like 6 months out? I mean, fairness, your energy levels can dip quite quickly. Like, Lord knows, 6 months ago,
life happens. Life happens.
Paul Gallagher, of course, says, given that he runs Buzzwells, has probably heard nothing but speculation about when the election is going to be. So our apologies, Paul, that we will mire you back in that kind of discussion after this break. With me is Francis Fitzgerald, former Fine Gael minister and MEP, Conor Pope, consumer affairs editor with the Irish Times, and Paul Gallagher, non-executive director with Tourism Ireland and general manager of Buzzwells Hotel. And if you're unfamiliar, Buzzwells Hotel is, of course, directly across from Leinster House and is the place where a lot of TDs end up spending their time, and senators end up spending their time when they're overnighting in Dublin and spend their time discussing political issues. This means, Paul, that you have heard all of the scuttlebutt about when the election is going to be. What's the date?
Well, I gather from the colleagues in this room that it won't be the 29th of November, because Roderick O'Gorman wants it on the 29th of November, and it mightn't be the 6th of December because the toy show. So I would say it'll be pretty soon. Obviously, the Finance Act has to get through the House, but I think it'll be this side of Christmas. I think to run it after Christmas, you end up at the trolleys and hospitals and other issues that cannot be predicted right now are probably going to come along. So I think they'll go as quickly as they can.
And is that the sense that you're getting from the chat that you're hearing when you're looking at the TDs and senators who gather in your lobby? Is there a sense of people want to get out, stick up posters and get on with it?
I think everybody's talking about it. It would appear that Simon Harris and Micheál Martin don't seem to be talking about it, which is incredible. Everybody else in the country is. I suppose not, you know, having a photograph in the paper of all of the Micheál Martin posters last week is interesting. And I'm starting to see them around my own neighbourhood. You've seen posters going up. So I think everybody's just ready. It's just someone needs to get the starting gun.
I think those posters are for local meetings these kind of people are having. It's just entirely coincidental that they're also running for election.
We call that campaign mode.
Now, one of the issues, of course, in this is timing in relation to the politics of it all and when the likely biggest advantage is. And for the last number of days and weeks, people have been saying, well, look, because of what Sinn Féin are suffering through, if you were Simon Harris, you would now pull the trigger on the starting gun. However, with every passing day, Sinn Féin seem to face new issues. And this is the case today. Front page of the Sunday Independent, the young man involved in the text scandal, and I mean involved in the sense that he was the recipient of the texts in question from Niall O'Donnell. He has come out to say that Mary Lou McDonald's praise of the former senator on his departure, or the good words that she said about him, was, quotes, like a mental stab. Mm. And he is calling in the Sunday Independent for a complete apology, not just for her words, but for the entire way Sinn Féin has dealt with this.
Yeah, it's a terrible story for Sinn Féin, but it's a reflection of how difficult this was for the teenager. And I think, first and foremost, you have to bear in mind that this is a teenager who's been at the centre of this story, and I'm sure it's the last thing they wanted. I'm sure it's the last thing their family wanted. But the statement is really, really hard-hitting, to use the words, in the Sunday Independent. And it's going to put more pressure on Sinn Féin. He contradicts key details of the incident that she put on the record in the Dáil. He said that one of the key details is Mary Lou McDonald said that the PSNI had told Sinn Féin that that the teenager was, quotes, content with the actions taken by the Sinn Féin party. But his statement makes it clear that he was not content. In a statement, he said that it was like a mental stab. He just talked about how distressed he was, and she has subsequently apologised. She said In a statement to the Indo last night, she said she apologised for the hurt her words caused to the teenager, but she didn't apologise for the party's handling of the issue. And I think that
now, in her defence, she apologised in some detail for her words. She said she was deeply sorry and angry that this young person had to endure this inappropriate and unacceptable behaviour. And she said that she was equally sorry that her words, when Niall O'Donnell resigned, caused distress to this young person that was never her intention.
And that's absolutely right. And it is it's a full apology from her. And you have to acknowledge that. But I think that the criticism is that there's no apology for how the party handles the issue. And I think that's what's going to be front and centre for the next couple of days. But like, it's a really, really depressing and upsetting story because, you know, these are vulnerable teenagers. The teenager in his statement says that when he approached somebody from Oghir Sinn Féin at one point, he was told, well, remember, you're a very small cog and, you're dealing with very heavy hitting people here. So, you know, you want to watch out. And that kind of...
That's from the piece he said in the Sunday Independent today. That's right.
And that's, you know, that kind of language and that kind of sentiment being expressed to a vulnerable teenager really is unacceptable. And I think it's clear that that his concerns should have been dealt with in a different way. I think everybody would acknowledge that. Even Sinn Féin would probably acknowledge that. But in terms of the politics of it, and it seems kind of lurid to talk about the politics of the story because ultimately you have a teenager who was distressed by this, but it couldn't be worse for the party. And I mean, if you think that 3 weeks ago people were talking about how things were bad for Sinn Féin and then they got worse and now they've got immeasurably worse again. You've seen that in the poll in the Sunday Times. I think the Sinn Féin support has now fallen to 16%. And remember, if we were in studio this time last year, we would have been talking about Sinn Féin being the party of government.
Foregone conclusion.
Mary Lou McDonald would be the next Taoiseach, the first woman Taoiseach. And all of that stuff is now out the window. And the question mark, there's going to be serious question marks hanging over her leadership, hanging over the future of the party, because we're heading into an election. They struggled really badly in the local elections. They could struggle really badly in the general election. And if they do, they could spend an awful long time into the future in the wilderness of opposition.
We'll have a look at that, the details of that poll in a second. But just on that thing of the politics of it, the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday has a quote from Simon Harris. And it said that Sinn Féin's reaction to this crisis is repugnant. Is there any danger, Paul, that the government party might over-egg the political making hay out of this, that it would be seen as tasteless to make political capital out of something of this nature?
Yeah, I think it could be seen that way. I think there has to be balance. So, you know, Sinn Féin have been riding the government hard from the opposition benches now for a number of years and doing very well at it. So, you know, you can understand why now government benches are now taking some satisfaction, perhaps, in Sinn Féin's predicament. But I suppose the overriding concern here is the duty of care, really. It has been totally missed, you know, as from Sinn Féin's point of view. We all have a duty of care, and particularly where we have people who are under 18. And clearly there's a power imbalance has revealed itself here. And there's been no equity in the way this gentleman's been treated. And that's, that. You know, you see that in the newspapers this morning. But, you know, there is a bit of history with this sort of stuff. And, you know, Maria Cahill would have had similar concerns with Sinn Féin. And I think we discussed earlier, you know, that Sinn Féin probably doesn't have the supports that the other main parties have, that they don't have that sort of big office background to deal with these sort of things as they arise. And this has shown Sinn Féin to be, you know, probably not fit for government because they won't be able to deal with the really nitty-gritty issues.
Although undoubtedly Sinn Féin will say that there was a process that was followed, and Mary Lou McDonald has made that very clear in terms of their governance in relation to other issues, that there is an internal process, that it is written down, that it is delineated and codified, and that it was followed in this instance. I am putting words slightly in their mouth, but I would assume they would also say that it is unusual for somebody to emerge from a process like this totally content with the experience. So the fact that the young man may not be contented with where this has left does not necessarily mean that they did not handle it correctly.
Yeah, I know, but you see Mary Lou McDonald then praising the senator in his post having resigned because he had health issues. I mean, that just doesn't square a circle, to be honest. And I think people will be left a little taste in their mouth that there was an opportunity to have a clear break between what happened and what was the outcome. And in fact, it all got glossed over. And, you know, this is a problem where you see people in powerful positions. And you think of like Hugh Edwards in the BBC, similar sort of stuff going on text to a young man. And now we have this. You just can't get away with it. And people shouldn't get away with it.
Now, what about the political implications and the electoral implications? Francis, if you were in Sinn Féin and you were looking at maybe 6 weeks, how do you turn around a slide? Because one of the things that really matters in politics is that sense of momentum. 12 months ago, 18 months ago, Sinn Féin were the coming party and it had that momentum. How do you get it back?
Well, it's going to be very challenging for them. At the end of the day, the public will decide. I mean, it is about how the public see this. And I think this story in the Irish Independent today of the young teenager talking about the mental stab that he felt when she praised the senator is very key, because it shows that something was missing when she made that statement. And of course, that's what in the Dáil she's been accused of. But to hear it from the victim himself, that was his experience. How can you praise this person when you actually know what happened? But I think the stories speak for themselves. And I think Shane Coleman has a very interesting article in the Business Post where he talks about the style of politics that is Sinn Féin. He calls it democratic centralism. And it's almost, and he says, all can be traced back to the party's military background and its democratic centralist structures. And this, you know, idea of this very strong rule from the top. And it, to me, and I mean, I was a practicing social worker, I brought in the child protection guidelines in legislation, I should say, in 2015. You know, the whole idea is you put the child at the centre. You don't protect the structures, the bureaucracy, the party. You do the right thing by the victim, you know, as both Conor and Paul have been saying. And it's as if those sort of structures aren't built into the DNA of the party yet.
Is that a bit of a reach? I mean, to go from a position of saying that there is an issue that hasn't been handled to the satisfaction of the victim, and then take the leap to say that it is to do with the legacy of the entire party. Is that not a bit much?
Well, I mean, this is what Shane is saying here. And I mean, there does seem to be something missing. Now, you'd have to, I mean, the history of Sinn Féin, you would have to know exactly how the party works. But aren't there a lot of their own members expressing dissatisfaction with that over-centralised control as well? You can only go, I don't know, but you can only go by what people are saying who have direct experience of the party, not just victims, but also members.
This has taken a number of other stories and pushed them further into the papers than they might otherwise have been. One of them, Conor, fits sort of in your remit because it is to do with expenditure, and it is to do with expenditure on flights. And this relates to Simon Harris and the bill that he has racked up on what is being called private jets, but I assume it is the government jet or a charter jet to replace it when it's broken down, because it's broken down a lot.
Yeah.
How much has he spent in the last 6 months?
Just under €500,000. On flights over the last 6 months. Now, this is a perennial story in newspapers, that there's always this outrage about how much politicians are spending on flights. I'm not sure if we can expect Simon Harris to fly Ryanair to Brussels or Charleroi or whatever it might be and get the best value for money. I don't think that's what we can expect. And when you look at the breakdown of some of the flights,
let me be very naive, Conor, but I can't. Why not?
Well, that's a very good question, I suppose. You would imagine that he's flying
pressure,
a team of people,
time,
that he has to get to Brussels at a certain time. He's working in Dublin. He has to get to Brussels. And, you know, he can't be reliant on the sometimes flaky schedule of regular airlines. So maybe that. Okay, but leave it aside. There's also flights here, fairly expensive flights to Ukraine, fairly expensive flights to Eastern Europe. He is the head of state. He is the Taoiseach, and he is doing the business of the state. So the fact that the flights cost a lot of money, I don't think should come as any great surprise. I think 500,000 does seem like a lot, but my understanding, based on what Frances said to me a few minutes ago, so I'm going to blame her entirely for this if it's wrong, is that the government jet is currently not operational. So all of these flights are chartered flights. And I would imagine that the cost of a chartered jet is really, really expensive, you know?
March 5th, 2024, the Taoiseach needs to go to Bucharest. He's flying Baldonnel, Bucharest, Baldonnel, return. It cost €97,000 for him to go to Bucharest.
It does seem dear.
€97,000, Francis, for one return flight.
Yes, it does sound like a lot. But the point about it is that I think you have to look at the overall picture of the scale of demands on a Taoiseach of a country, representing the country, working, you know, God knows how many hours per day here, taking off to go to a meeting that would last several hours, getting back. I don't know how many direct flights there are to Bucharest and what times, but I'm sure there was a very good reason to use that. And the scale of demand
Zurich,
is like...
A return flight to Zurich for 60K. Surely, if they come to and said, Taoiseach, we need you to go to Zurich tomorrow. It's going to cost €60,000. Well, can you move my meetings either side of it a little and maybe save €59,000?
I think it reflects the scale of pressure, of time pressures on a Taoiseach, and particularly an extraordinarily busy, as you know, energetic, hardworking Taoiseach like Simon Harris, and to do it in the most timely and efficient way possibly in terms of his timetable. I think that's the reality of it.
I think also that it's not just Simon in the plane on his own. So I'm sure there are 10 or 12 people with him. So if you divide it in then by 10 or 12 people, it doesn't sound as bad. But perhaps you shouldn't go to Bucharest so often.
I'm moving now towards the Anton camp, as Anton detailed the numbers. I think you're right. For flights to big cities like Zurich, you're right. I'm sure there's regular planes that he could have taken. I know that an awful lot of government ministers and junior ministers do take regular flights, so it shouldn't be beyond the capacity of the Taoiseach.
Look, 2 years ago, that government jet was breaking down. I remember it 7, 8, 9 years ago. There were issues with maintenance. It's now being replaced, and I think until it's replaced, the bills are going to be higher. I don't know what the difference is between those flights and. But you know, you're always on a losing wicket when you're trying to defend something like this. But I would say the timetable is extraordinarily demanding.
But when we look at things like the bike shed and the OPW spending as much as was spent on it, when we look, does it go to a thing of a general profligacy with the taxpayers' money?
Well, you always have to be conscious of that, and people are very concerned about it, no doubt. I mean, I think we have to bring in, you know, stricter and stricter rules in relation to the spending of public money. I do agree with that. And of course, I don't think any politician was involved in that particular bike shed, but that's beside the point. It's public money, and we're responsible for the overall spending of public money. And we do have, it doesn't matter that the economy is going so well, that there's a surplus, you always have to be conscious of value for money. And no better person than Conor Pope here to talk about that.
Well, we're going to put him to work after the break, because there's obviously a lot of coverage around value for money and the pressures in the restaurant sector and in the hospitality sector, which is obviously in Paul's wheelhouse as well, reporting on whether or not Shanahan's, the legendary Stephen's Green restaurant, is going to survive given its apparently temporary closure, and a lot of talk about what can be done to support the sector. More on that after this break. I'm joined by Francis Fitzgerald, former Fine Gael Minister, Taoiseach MEP, Conor Pope, Consumer Affairs Editor with the Irish Times, and Paul Gallagher, Non-Executive Director of Tourism Ireland and General Manager of Buzzwells Hotel, which places him well to talk about the coverage in the papers today about Dublin's pubs and restaurants and what needs to be done to, quote, save the sector, because there's been an awful lot of discussion about the sector being under pressure. Paul, can I ask you the question at the heart of this? We talk a lot about restaurant closures. Hand in hand with that, there are a lot of restaurant openings. Restaurants has always been a really high risk, really faddish industry to be in. So are we just focusing more on the downside of a thing that has always been the case, or is there a particular crisis now?
I think there's probably a particular crisis. I mean, the Restaurant Association of Ireland say there are 615 closures last year, or in the year to date. I think what's striking about the closures at the moment is there are well-known restaurants that are closing. It's not not the pop-up restaurant that, you know, they had a go at it and it didn't work, and 5 years later the lease is over and they're out. And that's probably what's kind of a little bit shocking, the foundations of restaurants generally, that these big guys with big resources, with multiple restaurants, are closing their restaurants. So I think that's one of the huge worries. And there's something fundamentally broken, I think, about the way buildings and landlords must be creating the leases for restaurants now, that is making it entirely, you know, unviable to actually either stay in business or to have a go at opening a business.
And is that where you see, because we hear VAT quoted as a problem, we hear the quality of the tourism offer in Dublin and how attractive it is as being part of the problem, and we hear leases as part of the problem. You would say leases are the critical thing?
I think they are a hugely important piece, because it's the premises. I mean, you can't run a restaurant from home. I can't run a hotel from my bedroom. So You know, and you would see at the moment every street in any town, city in Dublin and Ireland, where there are vacant restaurants, and they've been vacant for quite some time. And the question has to be, why is the landlord still holding out either for a high rent for a vacant premises, when in fact that vacant premise is acting as a detractor for that town or cityscape? And then right side by side, you're seeing, you know, the pub going, the bank is closed down, you know, a number of different things. So you're seeing a hollowing out of Irish towns and cities, and that is going to impact tourism long term.
Sorry, I listed three things. I, of course, missed the fourth, which is wage rates. Is that a challenge, particularly for people in your
sector? I don't think there's anything to be gained by talking about the level of pay for people. I think, you know, we all have to pay people a proper wage. I think that's just, you know, I think if you're going to blame wages, I think that's a problem for an owner. I think that's something that's difficult. But what is a problem is the unrelenting increases that restaurants and people in the food business are experiencing. So hotels as well, who are very food-centric. I mean, I have some costs with me. You know, potatoes are up 64%. Napkins are up 60%. Chicken is up 68% in cost. My own hotel, 1st September, our water rates went up by 33%. That was just it. So instead of being 18,000, it's going to be 26,000. But they're all cumulative impacts on businesses who have very small margins, not so much my own hotel, but a restaurant where they're operating on a 2 or 3% margin, a water rate increase of 33% does factor, and it does keep these restaurateurs. But
particularly if you combine it with one of the most common proteins, one of the most common carbohydrates, leaping by 60% as well. That's difficult to absorb. Sure.
So, I mean, the VAT is sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, that the restaurateurs wanted to keep that VAT margin and to help support their business. And I don't think the general public were going to give out about 4.5%. I don't really think they were going to. And that would probably save a number of them. But there is an issue. Yeah, I think it would. There is an issue, of course. There is some legacy issue now because of COVID. So there are years of no profit, of course. Perhaps there are years where the landlord continues to charge rent or only shaved a wee bit off to reflect the state of the economy. But there is also tax warehousing in the background that is obviously a factor as well. So all of that together, I think, has just created something.
This tax warehousing, this is the tax bill left over from COVID that has been forgiven for
some time. Yeah, so you could park your employment taxes and VAT taxes and come to an arrangement later on to pay. And these, I think, it has just come at a unique moment in time where they can't afford any of that now, and the VAT perhaps would have saved them.
Connor, you look at this all of the time. Would you agree with Paul's analysis?
Well, I'm kind of conflicted here because I have huge sympathy for the hospitality sector, and I think the government has betrayed them in a really significant way, because there's more than 300,000 people employed in the hospitality sector around the country. They're employed in every small town and village around the country. So unlike, you know, the big tech companies that are centred around Dublin City, Cork, to a lesser extent, maybe some other cities, these places are the lifeblood of every single town and village in Ireland, and they need to be supported to the same degree, if not more, than the big tech companies. Now, as a state, we are falling all over ourselves and have been for 50 years to give these big foreign multinational companies tax breaks. I don't see why we couldn't have given the hospitality sector the 9% that they were looking for. I think if it would have saved 10 restaurants, if it would have saved 5 restaurants, it would have been worth it. And I think it probably would have saved more. But more than the actual cash, it would have been a message from the government, from the state, to these small businesses that we value what you do. You not only do you provide all that employment, you also create a unique proposition for tourism. And we are absolutely dependent on tourism in this country.
You said you were conflicted, though.
Sometimes I look at the prices and I am just slack-jawed at the prices. And I was in a hotel this morning on the way in here. I stopped just to get a cup of coffee.
Two cups of coffee.
And I looked at some of the menu prices. A bowl of porridge, €9. A cup of coffee, €4. A croissant, €4. Now, I look at that and I say, that's scandalous. Like, I don't care how... I'll rephrase that. I understand how difficult it is for the hospitality sector. Charging the guts of a tenner for a bowl of porridge. Now, I don't care how much compote goes into that porridge, because obviously it comes with a berry compote or some kind of thing. It's too much. And I think people look at those prices and they go, do you know what? We're struggling with the cost of living crisis. We can't afford things. And yet here you are gouging us with these high prices that are just wildly out of whack with the costs that you're facing. And I think that's the issue that people have. They feel like they're being ripped off by the hospitality sector. So there isn't that level of sympathy that, frankly, the hospitality sector deserves. Because the hospitality sector is really important.
If you look up in the dictionary, fixed stare, there is a picture of Paul Gallagher with his current expression on. Paul, do you want to respond to any of this?
Well, I think not unlike, you know, basing the Taoiseach's activity on the price of flights, I don't think you could base pricing hotels on a pot of porridge.
In fairness, that's just one example. Like,
yeah,
I've had 50.
But the listeners are listening to
£9 porridge.
And there's probably millions of listeners to this program. You know, I think hotels generally have a breakfast price and it's either continental or it's full. And if you take a full breakfast, it's probably around 20 odd euros.
22 actually.
Okay, 22. 22 euros for a 3-course meal of breakfast is pretty good if you think about, you know, cereals, hot, cold meats, and then you get a hot breakfast on top of that.
Oh, no, that wasn't the price, actually. Just to be clear, the 22 euros was for a rasher, sausage, some bacon, hash brown, beans.
Okay, but you're not sitting
on the
side of a...
We're getting into the details of the menu here now, Anton.
Yeah, but you're not sitting on the footpath having it. You're sitting in a chair and someone's serving to you, and there's music in the background, and there's insurance cover, and there's, you know, there's all of that. So I think, you know, it's not like a porridge to go. It's not. You could be sitting at the table for half an hour having
that
porridge.
That's a good defence.
So I think, you know,
can I make some points about
price, value for money is about more than just price. So I think, you know, we want to be careful we don't boil it down to price.
No, but before Francis, I have repeatedly said that exact thing in the Irish Times, that value for money is about more than price. And I think sometimes people can get hung up on the price. And I want to be very clear, I'm not getting hung up on the price here. I mentioned the price because it's relevant. But value for money is an entirely different thing. So I can eat in Chapter One and I can spend €450 on a meal, wildly expensive, but tremendous value for money. So it's not the price necessarily, but it's the value. And far too often in Ireland, not in this particular hotel that I was looking at, far too often people are paying through the nose for mediocre food. And you know that, I know that, Anton and Francis know that.
I want to come in.
I mean, it would have cost between 600 and 700 million to do that VAT rate. And, you know, they ran out of money in relation to the work that needed to be done, taxes on. But I think there are broader questions in this debate and we need to broaden it out. And I think it has been broadened out in the media. I think this article by Colm Lauder today is really interesting in the Sunday Business Post. It's about the role of landlords and leases and about, while it might seem illogical for landlords to be cutting rents and allowing more flexibility in lease terms for the hospitality sector, the impact of vacancy and urban neglect would hit capital values far harder long term. And he's looking for more flexibility from landlords to continue this vibrancy we've seen in Dublin. And I did read in the Irish Times yesterday that the cost of food in the average households has gone from something like 24-28% down to 16%.
Well, on that quote for Connor's paper, that is the point where we will have to close. Connor Pope from the Irish Times, Francis Fitzgerald, former Fine Gael MEP and Minister, and Paul Gallagher, Non-Executive Director of Tourism Ireland and General Manager of Buzzwells. Thank you all very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.